In her new book, the NPR science reporter Maiklene Duclef explores how ancient parents raised their kids, and also parents in indigenous cultures. Because when she would look around at the studies behind modern Western parenting, she noticed a lot of these approaches just didn't really work. And so she wanted to know, you know, how they used to do it or how others do it. She wanted to know this not just as a reporter, but as a mother who was struggling with a precocious and headstrong kid. And she says she first witnessed this different parenting style a few years ago on a reporting trip.
They had sent me to the Yucatan for a series we were doing on parenting around the world. And I had read this study about how Maya children were better at paying attention in certain scenarios than Western kids or European American kids. And I wanted to figure out why. And so I went down to this little village and, you know, spent 4 days talking to parents, mostly moms, and, you know, watching them interact with their kids. And I quickly realized that there was a much bigger story than the attention story. And it was about the parenting. One mom in particular, Maria Tumburgos, she just had this calm, confident way of parenting that I had never seen before in San Francisco or in my growing up in Virginia. There was no yelling, no arguing, bickering. There was just very little resistance. And yet it was so effective. The children were kind, kind to each other, kind to their parents, respectful. But most of all, they were helpful. So I was talking to Maria in her kitchen for a while, and her three daughters were on spring break, and they had stayed up late the night before watching a shark movie. And so she was like letting them sleep in. And I think it was around 10 or 11, I can't remember. The oldest daughter, Angela, who's 12, woke up and walked right past and started washing the dishes. Like that was the first thing she did in the morning. I was just so surprised. I was like, you know, does this happen all the time? You know, like, is she doing this because I'm here? And Maria said, you know, she doesn't always do it, but she's 12 and she knows what needs to be done. And so she does it. I just like left there just being kind of like, was it real? Like, but also just like, you know, what were these parents doing? And like, what was I not doing?
And of course, you're filtering as you're reporting these stories, you're having not just a professional reaction. It's a deeply personal reaction because you are trying to figure out how to deal with your daughter.
I was shocked that when I would try some of the things that I learned, how incredibly effective they were with my little girl. So when I first went to the Yucatan, she was two, and she was starting to, I mean, she's always been like a hot firecracker of a kid, like lots of screaming, very strong-willed. You know, she walked really early, talked early, like everything is just done fast and furiously. But around 2.5 or 3, we really started to have problems with her. And I felt like her enemy, like we were just fighting and we were kind of constant power struggle. And she got in this habit of having a tantrum and I would pick her up and then she would like just smack me across the face. And I really had no clue what to do about it. And here I was like seeing this other way of relating to children. It seemed so different than what I had been taught. I thought, you know, I'm going to just give it a try, mostly because I'm desperate, like completely desperate. And every time I tried a little piece of it, it really just felt like, oh, whoa, this is working and this is making our lives better and our relationship better, which was so key.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Maiklene Duclef is joining us this hour. Her book is called Hunt, Gather, Parent. And what she wanted to do was fill what she saw as this gap in our parenting knowledge. Because in the West, over the generations, for reasons she explores in the book, parents had set aside some of these strategies that had been honed for thousands of years by hunter-gatherers and maintained by indigenous cultures. The idea for the book was to travel to these different places and to see how they raised their kids. And what she found were these amazing parents, master motivators, people who are expert at teaching skills like resilience and patience and how to control anger. As a mom, Maiklin Duclef had her own test case nearby, her own daughter, Rosie, who is, how to put this, well, a force of nature.
Every morning would just be such a struggle, right? We would be trying, you know, this is pre-pandemic, we would be all trying to rush out the door to get put Rosie to preschool and me to work and my husband to work. And it would just, nothing could get done. Like, you know, we couldn't find the shoes. We couldn't get the, she wouldn't get dressed. She wouldn't eat food. You know, I would try to get her to get her shoes on. I mean, getting shoes on was just this, like, every day was like a constant struggle. One day I asked her to put her shoes on and she started taking off her clothes and taking off her underwear. And I laughed, but it was just, it was horrible. And I remember that morning, just like she was screaming and my husband was mad because, you know, we were all late. And I like kneeled down and just like just thought, like, why is it all so hard? I mean, every day was like that. I cannot exaggerate the struggle. And to be honest, I kind of given up. To be really honest, I kind of like I said, preparing for battle. It was just like in the morning sitting there being like, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to say to her? Am I going to duck? Am I going to, like, when she hits me? I mean, we were kind of desperate. And I have to say that we tried so much stuff. Like, we read so many books and I just never, I always thought it was me. Like, I was doing it wrong. And I think while writing this book, I realized that it wasn't me. I think a lot of the advice is just not that good.
Well, and no one had taught you how to be a good mom, you say. The culture had kind of forgotten this other idea of doing it. Because you also mentioned that there's this, you came from an angry home. I mean, you grew up in an angry home. So that was your role model, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's how, you know, I behaved as well as a child at some point because I was afraid of anger, right? I was afraid of my dad being angry at me and yelling at me or being punished. And that was really the only tool I knew as a parent is to get angry. You know, a kid slaps you, you get angry. And even not even that hard, like a kid disobeys you, you get angry, you yell, you know. I didn't know there was another way to do it. And I tried on Google and in books and stuff to figure out another way. But I think our parenting advice right now is just missing this like core element and this core way of interacting with a child. And that was what I was really like trying to understand while writing Gathered Parent, was this like very likely very old, given how common it is around the world. Like a very tried and true method that parents have just like turned to over and over again. And when you see it and you see it working, it kind of, like I say in the book, like it just was like, oh, it just like, it fits like a hand in a glove. Right. So yeah, you're right. I think that our culture has kind of lost this understanding of how children are and how they respond to being parented.
I guess one of the things that, and this is a really key point that you write about in the book, is that by far the majority of parenting advice comes from this Euro-American perspective. There's this Western paradigm. And you really dig into this part of it. And I wondered, and well, control is a big part of that. And we'll get to that in a second here. But one of the things you write about is that you learned from these hunter-gatherer and other indigenous cultures that they had this useful knowledge that for some reason, we in the West stopped using this as a model. And somewhere down the line, it seems like we kind of separated ourselves from this useful knowledge. And I'm wondering why you think that is. Did we think that it seemed uncivilized or not tidy or structured enough? Like, what is it about Western culture? You know, we were science-based, we're industrialized. Why did we start resisting these other ideas?
It's a good question. It requires a long answer. You know, one of the key things that I talk about in the book is how we've lost the teachers of this knowledge. So parents learn to parent from the other adults that live around them, right? And so, you know, I talk about in the book how around about 1500, you know, so what is that, like 500, 600 years ago, the Catholic Church started enacting some laws that prevented marriages. So at the beginning, it was like cousins and things that were, you know, legitimately probably people probably shouldn't marry because of, you know, but genetic reasons. But over time, they started extending out these rules to like sixth, seventh cousins. So there's no reason why you can't marry your sixth cousin. You guys are not related really at all. Or even to in-laws, right? And so what this did actually—
they're obsessed about incest, right?
Yes. Okay. You can say, yes, the Catholic Church became obsessed with incest as one of the researchers at Harvard says, and that's right. And in this research out of Harvard, it, you know, points to this idea that these laws broke up these very large extended families. And that if you look around the world and throughout human history, people lived in big families, right? There's grandparents, great grandparents, aunts, cousins, some, you know, non-related people, neighbors, friends. And in these rules, these Catholic Church rules over time kind of cracked that these extended families and shattered them into pieces. And eventually, you know, other things were involved, but you end up with this nuclear family idea, right? That the ideal family structure is a mom and a dad raising two kids, right? Maybe a dog. And that's what a lot of us have, right? In our lives. That's what I have. But what happens is that you lose the teachers for the parents, because the way people learned to parent was by watching the older people parent the younger ones, right? And there's this like slow kind of apprenticeship that goes on. And then when you have a baby, you know, you've got like an aunt or a neighbor that's there with you. And it's this very collaborative, cooperative approach. But then right now we're just left with none of that. And so I think that this core element and this way of relating to kids, that's part of why we lost it, is because we've lost the teachers. I also think that a lot of science that happened about 200 years ago, when we decided that parents weren't the parenting experts, but these doctors and, you know, parenting experts were these parenting experts and started writing books about it, ironically.
Yeah. You say in the book that how we in the US and other Western countries, we scold parents of different cultures who don't follow our culture's rules. And so there's that element too. But then it's another important point that you also make is that let's not over romanticize other cultures like they have, as you say in the book, some kind of ancient magic to all of this, because that's not helping either, that kind of idea, I guess.
No, they're both wrong, right? They're both just, like I say in the book, categorically wrong.
Right.
And we do this very swing thing, right? It's just wrong, or it's like romanticized. Yes, but at the same time, it is very well documented that many cultures in the world, you know, from on every livable continent, don't struggle with some of the things that we struggle with. And that's, I think, what this book is about, is this idea that, you know, no culture is perfect. There's no like parenting utopia, but you know, some cultures are better at things than we are, you know, and we're better at other things. And so, yeah, like we have a very, very narrow view of parenting. We get advice basically from a European American or a Western perspective. But there's so many other voices out there. You know, Hunt Gather Parent is really just to like say, hey, look, there's, let's just start talking about all these other voices and these ways of parenting and value them and see that there can be value in them. And I think it will help us all, you know, in the end. So yeah, we definitely don't want to romanticize. But I do think a lot of cultures, you know, not just in this book, but beyond, have a lot to bring, a lot of value to bring.
Maiklene Duclef. We're talking about her new book, Hunt, Gather, Parent, What Ancient Cultures Can Teach Us About the Lost Art of Raising Happy, Helpful Little Humans. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
– KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what parents today can learn from different cultures about how to raise their kids. NPR science reporter Maiklene Duclef has written a book where she traveled around the world exploring parenting practices in other places and in other times in human history. Part of this was personal. She was feeling overwhelmed as a mom. Her book is Hunt, Gather, Parent. So let's talk about this study that was done by the University of British Columbia, because these researchers wanted to find out how the human brain works. But not just the, you know, European-American brain, all human brains. And they discovered this, as we've been talking about, this Western bias, and that North Americans aren't necessarily representative as cultures. In fact, we're the outliers here. We have a different kind of sensibility, a different way of perceiving
psychology,
all of that. Talk a little bit about this, because it's important for us to understand how different we see the world, right?
Yeah. So this came about because these researchers were looking at the bias in psychological research. They were wondering, you know, like how much of research is done on, you know, European Americans versus every other culture in the world, you know, thousands and thousands of cultures. And what they saw, I think, is that like basically 96% of all psychological research is done on this very, very select group of people. I think that European Americans or Westerners make up about 12% of the population. And yet 96% of the studies were on this group of people. And so there's no way that this is representing humanity or how the brain works. But also when you look at it, when you look at the studies and you look at the ones that weren't done on Western folks, what you see is that oftentimes the European American or the Western people are the outliers, in that other cultures tend to, especially like more indigenous hunter-gatherers, tend to group together. And so if anything, you know, these cultures that are only 4% represented in the literature, they're way more representative of, you know, how the human brain would work or how people are than Westerners. What these researchers in British Columbia, what they basically said is actually Western cultures, they call it weird, Western, educated, industrial, rich, and democratic are actually the strangest people in the world and the weirdest people in the world. And we are the least representative of kind of humanity because we do things that are really crazy and our brains work in a way that's kind of really crazy.
So let's talk about some of these different places. Tell us about Chan Kahal, this tiny Maya village.
Yes. So that is a little village in the Yucatan, about 2 hours from 2.5 hours from Cancun. It's about, I forgot how, a few thousand people. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And like I said, this is where I first went. Yeah. And I think about the moms there all the time because they are incredibly skilled, the moms that I met, at motivating children, like I said, to be helpful around the house, to be kind, to be generous. And anthropologists and psychologists have documented this, this is not just me. And then the second place we went to is Kukarok in Nunavik, up in above the Arctic Circle. And this is a little like fishing town right on the Arctic Ocean. This is an incredible place where maybe in the 60s, the families there were still living a more traditional lifestyle. They were nomadic. And so, you know, along with that comes the parenting.
Which is what you describe it as, this nurturing, tender approach. I love, in fact, this special kiss that they have for the kids that you describe.
Oh, gosh. Yes. It's like you put your nose on the cheek of the child and you sniff. It is very, very wonderful that what I saw, what I was taught up there is this incredible, gentle, tender way of interacting with children. And a lot of it comes, I think, from the way that children are, the motivations of children are viewed. So I asked a lot of parents, because I was trying to figure out what to do when Rosie bites me and hits me. And, you know, I think I mentioned like, oh, she's pushing my buttons. She's pushing boundaries. And one of the moms like even laughed at me and was like, she's not pushing your buttons. Like, she's 2 years old. She doesn't know how to push buttons. And I was like, well, what's she doing then? You know? And they, you know, they said that she's just too young. So I think there's this in many cultures, it's not just in the Arctic, but in many cultures, parents view very young children as these irrational, illogical beings that don't have understanding yet. And it's the job of the parent to teach them that. So if they hit you or they're mean to you, it's not because they just don't know. And they're just these kind of, you know, immature creatures that you need to teach. And so if you get angry at them or scold them, you know, all you're teaching them is to get angry and to scold. But if you just realize, oh, they just don't know yet, and it's my job to guide them and gently guide them and teach them, then they will learn. They will learn over time through practice and through modeling.
Seems like that was one of the biggest insights in the book, one of the really powerful ones, because you say in the U.S. and other, you know, weird society.
Yes.
that we overestimate children's emotional abilities. We just think that they're further advanced than that, that they're being these manipulative little creatures when not really, not yet.
Yeah. I mean, my pediatrician told me to ignore Rosie's tantrums when she was like, you know, very young, by the sense that, like, you know, there was this sense that she should know better, or that this child should know better. And yes, yet controlling one's emotions, especially when you're angry, is incredibly hard, even for adults, right? So we're expecting like a 2 or 3 year old to do something that many adults can't do, you know, control when you get upset, controlling your emotions. So many parents around the world think that children are these, like I said, irrational beings that don't have emotional regulation. And again, it's the job of the parent, just like teaching them to read or to write, it's the job of the parent to slowly over time teach them to self-regulate. And you do that not by getting angry at them when they have a tantrum or even it's a very little kid and ignoring them. You do that by being gentle, and you do that by showing them a very calm, gentle way of being. And I saw, like, Rosie would start to have tantrums when we were in the Arctic, and Elizabeth, the mom I mentioned before, would come to her, you know, I would be like starting to yell at her, like, what's wrong? This like very intense energy, right? Like, what's the matter? Do you want this? Why are you doing this again? Don't you see I'm trying, you know, like this very, like, I mean, it's terrible, but then I saw Elizabeth just kind of go over to her. One day we were walking back from the store. It was like 10 o'clock at night and the sun was still up, you know, cause it's up almost the whole night. And Rosie was tired and cranky, and she kind of was like having a tantrum in the road. And I was going to go over there and, like, you know, lay into her. And Elizabeth went over to her and just said, just in the calmest voice, she said, do you see the beautiful sunset? Do you see the purple and the pink? And Rosie just kind of like immediately like responded to that calmness, right? And looked up at the sky and just kind of completely settled. And what Elizabeth was doing was, like, you know, allowing Rosie the practice of calming herself down, right? And like, and finding that response in herself. And I was just like, oh gosh, I have just been coming at these tantrums like the opposite way of what Rosie needed.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about this idea of alloparenting, which gets us to the experience you had with the Hadzabe, this community hunter-gatherers in Tanzania. Talk a little bit about this idea of alloparenting, which is really important. It's an important theme in the book.
Super, super important. Everywhere we went, and you know, everywhere, I would say in all of human history, right? There's very good evidence from evolutionary biologists that, you know, one of the reasons why our species has done so well compared to other Homo species is because of alloparenting. So allo is derived from the Greek for other. It's a term that scientists use basically for a caregiver other than the mom and the dad. And there's so much evidence, you know, if you look all around the world, alloparents play incredibly important roles in children's life from the moment they're born. So there's one study, I think, with the FA and in Africa hunter-gatherer group where like a baby is held by a different person every 15 minutes, like during the first couple of weeks of life. You know, when we were in the Arctic, you know, I watched a little 18-month-old, oh no, she was like 9 months, you know, like 9 or 10 different people were holding this baby and playing with this baby over a course of a couple hours. So this idea is that human babies are born incredibly incapable, right? They're premature. They need an enormous amount of calories and care, and that Sarah Blaffer-Hardy has really good evidence, this scientist, that human babies wouldn't survive unless, this is like a long time ago, right? Like hundreds of thousands of years ago, wouldn't survive without, you know, the mom and dad having a huge amount of help. So we're talking about not just people that come in and out of the kids' lives every couple of days. We're talking about people that are there helping the mom like all day long and the dad all day long, getting food, taking care, holding the baby. And so really, in a way, human children are designed to be raised and taken care of by, like, you know, a group of people, 4, 5, 6 people. And we've really turned that job, this group job, into, you know, something that 1 or 2 people is doing every day. What it made me realize is like to not feel guilty that I get tired of being with Rosie, yeah. That I don't want to be with Rosie all day long, all Saturday long. And there's a reason she's not made to be just with me or her father, but 2, to really like value the other people in her life, the people that live around us, our relatives. You know, and a huge, hugely important alloparent in many cultures is other children.
Yeah. Yeah.
So especially as kids get older, like past 2 or 3, kids will spend almost all their time out of school, you know, with older children. And they serve huge roles in teaching children and taking care of them. And it's good for, I mean, there's a lot of psychological evidence that it's good for both, right? It's good for the older kids and it's good for the younger kids.
You boil down these core elements into, there are 4 main elements that you write about, and it's the acronym TEAM. So we've talked about the T, the togetherness. You say that E, encouraging versus forcing, you say that may be the hardest one by far. Talk a little bit about the E part.
The idea is that like many of the parents I talk to say you can't force a child to learn. That if you try to force them through punishment or violence, or you're only going to demotivate them in the sense that they're not going to want to do the task voluntarily. They're only doing it because they're afraid of you. And in some instances, they will just stop doing tasks when you force them. And there's actually very good psychological evidence to back this idea that, right, if a child feels like they don't have a choice in the matter, they become demotivated, like their intrinsic motivation goes down. The thing is the difference here is that we've kind of lost a lot of tools of encouraging children. And there's a whole giant chapter in the book about these tools that are used. So it's not just throwing up your hands and being like, oh, well, the kid's, you know, not doing what I need, and the kid's not doing what we need the family to do. So, oh, that's it. No, that's not it at all. There's all these tools that the parents use to get the child to figure out the right behavior for themselves. So you encourage the right behavior through these tools. And over time, the child comes to the conclusion of, oh, I need to do this. I need to share my candy.
It was my idea.
Like, right, exactly. Right. I figured it out. And it's this idea that these tools cause the child to think, right? And figure out on their own what's right for them. And that allows the A of TEAM, which is autonomy. It allows the child to make their own decisions and self-govern, while at the same time, you know, respecting the family, respecting the community, being helpful, doing kind of following the rules, right? There are rules. It's just that the child is not being forced to do the rules. They're being encouraged. So A is autonomy, which is huge. If you look at hunter-gatherer communities all over, one of the biggest values is autonomy. So the right to make your own choices and your own decision. And that right is granted to even toddlers. But again, you don't walk all over people, right? There's actually this expectation that you're going to give back to the family. You're going to help. You're going to be responsible constantly, right? So it's not independence. It's different. You're still connected back. And then M is minimal interference, which is this idea that the parent is not turning away, letting the child do whatever. And the parent is not sitting there hovering over the child. The parent is in the background there and doing as little as possible to interfere with the child.
This minimal interference, I think, may get to this Western inclination we have for entertaining our kids. Like, we have to entertain them. Why is that? Explain that. And how does that differ from what you found in those other places?
Yeah. So this is one of those really weird things that David Lancey has documented. This idea that, like, it's the parent's job to keep the child, like, there's multiple ways of thinking about it: entertaining them, educating them, right? Instruction, and also keeping them busy, right? They're kind of all three the same. But this idea that the child can't just hang out with you and figure out what they're going to do. And throughout all of human history, and in the vast majority of cultures around the world, parents just go about their lives, go about their adult activities, and let children tag along, and then respond to the child. You know, like, if the child is interested and they want to join the task, they find a way to include the child. That could be like giving a small subtask. That could also be giving a little piece of the material. So, like, Rosie really wanted to make tortillas. Rosie can't make tortillas. So the mom gave her a little piece of dough and said, you know, go practice over here. Right. So she's including her in the task. And this is the way, I mean, there's a very good argument to make that this is the way children learn or evolve to interact with adults. This constant, like, okay, now you need a screen. Now you need a toy. Now you need me to tell you something or instruction is very, very new. Number one, we're talking about less than 100 years old, even like 50, and very strange. And I think that, I think we don't know what it's doing to our children. I think it's an experiment we're doing. I do think that there's evidence that it inhibits the child from learning to take initiative. And this is something I'm just starting to really appreciate, but it's this idea that if you're always telling the child what to do, they don't learn to take initiative. They don't learn to do something voluntarily. So there's a lot that gets talked about in Hunt Gather Parent about voluntarily doing chores. But in those studies that I cite, they also look at homework. And the kids that are voluntarily doing chores are also voluntarily doing their homework at night. So I think we need to think long and hard that if we're always determining the child's schedule and what they pay attention to, are we preventing them from developing the skill of, like, oh, now this needs to be done. You know, I think it's very, very interesting. To me, it's very interesting.
Yeah. You ask this question about whether, in fact, science really can help you learn to be, you know, a better parent. Because you're a scientist, you're a reporter.
I'm a scientist.
And I have a PhD in chemistry. Right.
I'm a hardcore scientist.
Hardcore. Yes. And when you had Rosie, you started reading and you figured out, you know, I'm going to find out what science has to say to help me. But then you started to encounter these problems as you go into the references and look at the studies. Talk a little bit about this idea that these studies are underpowered. There's this kind of confusing flip-flopping going on. Talk a little bit about that.
Psychology has had a little bit of a hard time recently because there's been this bias that's been exposed with, you know, we're only looking at this very small select group of people in the world. But another problem that psychology, and this isn't just about parenting, but psychology in general, is this question of whether the studies are reproducible. Like, whether, you know, in fact, if you went in and ran them on a different set of kids, would you get the same answer? And what the psychologist that has been studying this has found that actually very few are reproducible. We're talking about less than 20% for some parts of psychology. So the idea is, like, are these experiments useful? If you can't reproduce them on a bunch of kids, you know, are they right? And so what this guy told me, I said, you know, I thought that science could help me parent. I mean, clearly I'm very pro science, you know, medicine has helped kids in many, many ways. But I think when it comes to behavior, you know, teaching kindness, teaching helpfulness, the scientist told me, he said, you know, it's going to Mars is a much easier problem than having science teach us how to parent. And then he just laughed. And it's what you say. Many of the experiments are underpowered. So this is the idea that, like, they don't study enough kids. And so you just can't, there's too much noise. And so you run the experiment and you'll get an answer A the first time, and you run it again and you'll get negative A. And I think that this is why a lot of the advice flip-flops, right? There's a lot of advice flip-flops, like with very even non-behavioral things, like with peanut butter, like whether babies should eat peanut butter or not. In the last 20 years, that advice has completely changed 180 degrees. And it's because the studies are too small, and then they run them again and they get a different answer. And then eventually maybe somebody will run a giant one and they'll try to come to something that's right. But you know, the idea that science can tell you how to raise a helpful child, I think that we're, like he said, like the scientist told me, we're asking too much of science when it comes to that.
Yeah.
It's too complex.
There's this moment that you write about that seemed, I think, to me to say kind of everything about the essence of this universal approach to parenting by these indigenous cultures that you looked into. And that was this experience you tell later in the book about a toddler learning to walk. Would you talk about that? Because that difference seemed so powerful and kind of lovely.
It is lovely. This is from the anthropologist Susan Gaskins, who I cite throughout the book. So she says, you know, in the U.S., when a toddler is trying to learn to walk, the parent is holding onto the child's hands, sometimes in front, sometimes on the side, and coaxing the child along. Like, come on. Oh, yeah. Good job. Good job. You got it. Come on. Oh, yeah. You know, like this very like high intensity. But in the Yucatan, what she saw is that the mom is or the grandma or the big brother is behind the child and ready to catch the child when they fall. And there in the letting the little toddler make her steps. And so the toddler actually feels like she's doing it on her own, that she's doing it, and nobody there is telling her how to do it or, you know, praising her, but it's all her own. But the parent is there, the caretaker is there, ready to respond and ready to help her if she needs.
How has all of this changed, Rosie? And how has all of this changed you, this experience?
Oh my gosh. I can't understate what it's done to our whole family. I mean, to be honest, to my relationship with my husband, Rosie and I, like, we are so good. I mean, it's not perfect, and we still, you know, have our moments. But we work together. Like, I've really learned to value her opinion and her ideas and really want to build off them. And, you know, like I say in the book, like, sometimes she's one of my favorite people in the world. You know, she is. She's great. And we are no longer enemies. And I do not dread my time with her at all. Me personally, I have just learned to be so much less angry. I mean, just I've learned to devalue anger. You know, I think we think of that it's productive, and I'm sure it has its times, but I was overly valuing it and thinking that it could fix so many things. And what I realized was if I just stop being so angry and have less anger in the first place, view other people's motivations as genuine, and you know, view Rosie as wanting to help, wanting to be kind, but not knowing how, our relationship is just so much better. So much better. I can't say enough.
Let me ask you this finally. When you look at the, you know, the powerful cultural forces and all of these historical elements that have come together to make Western parents the way they are, it seems like it's going to take a lot of awareness and work and relearning to change things. And I wondered if you think, do we have it in us, you know, like the humility to change our approach to parenting?
That's, you know, it's interesting you bring up humility, because I think that that is so key. But, you know, I also want to say that, like, I mean, humility being like, I can learn another way. There's another way. There can be other ways and better ways. But I also think that a little bit of this approach is going to go a long way. So, you know, we're clearly not going to be able to shift everything and merge the adult world and the child world. And, you know, but just adding a little bit of it back in, you know, just taking the weekends or after school to bring them into the adult world, or, you know, reducing the anger, reducing the yelling, like just, I saw just even small changes with Rosie, like help so much, just help so much. We don't have to go all, we don't have to make these big swings, I think, to really make a difference in a child's life. There's even studies that show just one extra kind of allo parent in a child's life can be huge, can help the child overcome traumatic experiences. And, you know, so I think we don't have to be take it on so much, you know, just a little bit of it.
I like how you write about this insight from the writer Jenny O'Dell, who talks about what happens when people first begin to watch birds, how that awareness changes their senses.
Yeah. Yes, it's so true. So she says, you know, when you start to watch birds, you start to realize, holy cow, bird songs are everywhere, and that birds are everywhere, and they've been there the whole time, but you've never noticed them. And I had the same sense about children and helpfulness, that children want to help all the time. But if you're not aware of it and you don't realize it, you don't see it. And then once you start to become aware of it, it's like, it's everywhere. Like, Rosie wants to help me almost at every moment. And I couldn't see it before because I had these other narratives in my mind.
Maiklene Duclef, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
Maiklene Duclef, she's a correspondent for NPR Science Desk. Her new book is called Hunt, Gather, Parent. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, @RadioWest. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.